Next up, we're going to hear about Oregon agriculture, and we're going to get an economic update from Brian Fetch. And Brian Fetch grew up in agriculture near Pendleton, Oregon. He gained agricultural work experience in Germany before graduating from Oregon State University with a bachelor's degree in agriculture and natural resource economics. Brent joined the Northwest FCS in 1987 and served in a variety of field and headquarters roles, including regional vice president in the Dalles, Oregon, and senior vice president of community lending. Brent oversees the lending and insurance services team here in Oregon. So let's give a round of applause to Brent. And
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I thought I'd share. Ronald Reagan once said that if economists designed a Trivial Pursuit game, there'd be 100 questions and 3,000 answers. So, and as I think back, Marie Bowers asked if I'd be willing to come visit with you a little bit about economics really early this year. Earlier this morning, I was thinking, why did I agree to do this? But there's no shortage of topics in the area of economics and around the globe. So let's take a look at that. I thought what I'd do though is try to focus on some key areas that I think are most impactful to your operations as well as our business. And as I think about it from that perspective, I thought the key drivers that we'd spend a little time thinking about is labor, trade, energy, interest rates, and you folks are always interested in land value, so maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. Jumping right into it on labor, I thought I'd start with this population distribution for the 324 million people that live here in the United States. And I want to call to your attention a couple of things that I've done on the side of this slide. First of all, 39.6% in what demographers refer to as prime earnings years. Actually, that bothered me a little bit. It said 25 to 54, so that, according to them, I've only got about 12 more months of prime earning years, which is concerning because my 401k is not where it needs to be. As I head towards that next bracket, which is the 28% of our population in that baby boomer category, at or nearing retirement age. That's really the takeaway. If you remember, there's so many numbers that get thrown at you. The United States is in an aging demography or population, and that will have a profound impact on this topic of labor. And I took a look at some of our other countries just by comparison. If you look at that prime earnings of 39.6% of our population, as I look at Canada, Mexico, Germany, France, they're pretty much in the same boat. Where you see the difference at is in some of the growing populations. For example, if we compare our 39.6, Brazil is at 44%. So there's more a larger percentage of their population in those prime earning years in the workforce. But then our prior speaker talked about China. They're at 48%, nearly 10 points higher than us in that 25 to 54 age group. If you think about Africa, for example, they're expected to double their population from between now and 2050, that same time horizon in the narrative, how are we going to feed 9 billion people by the year 2050? A lot of that population increase is going to occur in sub-Saharan Africa. But let me bring it back to this issue of labor. I just showed the U.S. demographics because, when you think about it, an increasing number of folks are going to be in the retirement age, and what kinds of goods and services and buying behavior and what kind of labor will it take to support that? That's really the message here. And here's another key component. I'm sure you've seen that in the newspapers. So recently, unemployment hit its lowest level since December of 2000 at 4.1%. If you think back how the Fed was looking to drive unemployment below 6% and keep inflation under wraps. Well, we've certainly got to that point. The red line is the unemployment rate. Those blue bars represent net creation or loss of jobs. And I thought that in a rather big picture standpoint was interesting. You can see from 2011 forward, we've very consistently been net creation of jobs as opposed to the losses, the rather severe losses that occurred right after the financial crisis. So we're creating jobs and driving unemployment down to its lowest level in nearly two decades, and we all wonder why it's hard to find labor. But wait, there's more. Look at this graph. Because I don't have my glasses, 2001, at least I can read that one. So this is a long history of our declining labor participation rate. And just as an example, in October, 764,000 Americans dropped out of the workforce, increasing the total number of non-labor force participants to 4.2 million. That leaves 62.7% of us here in the United States available in the workforce. So every time we hear an unemployment rate quoted in a newspaper or other media, keep this in mind. 4.1% unemployment does not include the folks in this number. Again, the point I'm trying to drive at is, why is it so hard for you to find a harvest crew or farm labor? Same thing at Northwest Farm Credit. Why do we have to work so hard to find the talent and folks to work at our... some of these things play into that. And again, remember my first slide, where more and more folks are moving into that retirement age. I thought it was interesting. I found at least one... some indications of why is the labor participation rate declining. I've already mentioned one of them, the baby boomers moving into retirement. That's the most significant part. Some of them are retiring early, not me, as I already indicated. There's also a number of folks, 24% of those not participating have just fallen out of the workforce. They were looking for a job for 6 months or more and basically gave up. There's also a group that they, I can't give you the answer, but there's, it's just referred to as the mystery of the missing workers, that being people between 25 and 54, what I referred to earlier as that prime earnings years, that just aren't in the workforce. Explanations such as going back to school for additional education and things like that, but they're just out of the numbers, and we don't know. Here's one that really surprised me. I wasn't aware of that until I started to prepare my remarks for you today, and that is the increased use of opioid medication. I saw a Yale study that suggests, and I don't know that this is accurate or not, but at least one study suggests that 20% of that participation rate has to do with the opioid epidemic in this country. Something to think about. I've certainly seen our political representation pontificate on that, but I wasn't aware of how significant that issue might be to our country from a health standpoint. And the fifth reason that I've seen is just simply an increasing number of people too sick or disabled to work. So that's another factor in this labor issue. And we certainly have to talk about immigration and the historical trend. What this graph is showing is the documented and undocumented migrant farm worker change over time. And clearly the main reason I share this graph with you is to show the declining trend for a long time. Nearly 75% of what we would have historically referred to as migrant farm workers have settled and no longer migrate. I know that my wife and I built a house, and the framing crew that came out there was entirely Hispanic. And so I think there's just been a lot of changes in that area. I read a Wall Street Journal article that suggested that immigrants from Mexico declined from 7 to 5.9 million between 2007 and 2012. just trying to feed you all of these factors to help you get your minds and my mind around why, as I travel the state of Oregon and visit with our customers and stakeholders, is the number one issue that comes up in those conversations labor and the difficulty in finding it and the expense even once you do. I think that we need to think as an industry, that being a natural resources industry, about our traditional paradigm of getting labor, particularly from Mexico, but maybe even South America generally, because I think that we need to think about the same demographics that we just looked at for the United States, and where's Mexico at? Well, their prime earning years bandwidth in that histogram is nearly identical to our own. So they too have an aging population base. They're not among those that are growing. There's been significant changes over the last 15 to 20 years in terms of their own economic growth and prosperity. And I think that we will continue to see a declining trend as this graph shows. So one postulate I want to put out to you is just to suggest that often I hear that, well, we need immigration reform. And while that certainly might help relieve some of the pressure I know that you're facing, I'm not convinced, given the data, that it's a complete answer. I think that even if there was the political will, which is a big if, right, to tackle immigration reform without getting some unwanted consequences politically, I'm not sure that it's there. One other factor is declining productivity, and I spent some time on this. It's a little more erratic, but nonetheless, as you look across the time frame, the last 20 years, the best fit line there shows a decline in productivity output per hour. I should mention that this data is non-farm data, so it would be the services and manufacturing, but they intentionally excluded your businesses from this analysis. But nonetheless, it shows in the larger economy a general decline in productivity. One exception to that is in the third quarter of this year, there was a pretty significant increase of 3%, which was the highest in 3 years, and something I've been watching a lot. At Northwest Farm Credit, like any business, from time to time, in our case annually, we go out in the marketplace and review salaries to make sure that over time we stay competitive with our employees. And in recent years, there just hasn't been a significant change in real wages. Now, that doesn't mean that people aren't, you know, increasing their compensation, but across the economy, wages have been stayed pretty flat, which is odd because as we watch the stock market go up in excess of 24,000 and other economic indicators, inflation is low, why aren't real wages increasing with this growing economy? And a lot of that has to do with this productivity. I would mention, I said that we had a nice report in the third quarter that productivity increased 3%, but I have to remind you of Hurricane Harvey. There is some speculation that the reason it spiked up was related to the hurricane, and I also have to mention that a subset of that data is manufacturing actually went down 5%. So I'm not sure, film at 11 on that as we get fourth quarter and then first quarter of 2018 to see how that goes, but kind of watch that in the news if you see that. Remember this trend line, which isn't very encouraging. If that is sustained, the main reason I share this with you, if we do see an improvement in productivity, then we should also find those real wages increasing over time. And for obvious reasons, I know you're concerned not only about availability of labor, but once you've got that person hired, how much do they cost? That's something we can be watching. Here, I'll take you back to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Does anybody remember this graph? Does it show big enough? This is showing is the disconnect between productivity. Now, I've switched. I just talked about labor productivity. Now I'm talking about productivity in a broader economic sense. You see the hourly wage line is down below. Productivity has continued to climb, while wages, you can see, have stayed relatively stagnant. Now, these are real wages. But what happened in 1973 to cause that divergence? It's happening a lot in agriculture. I know what, politically speaking, the left came up and said, well, this is perfect evidence of how we need to boost, increase income equality in the economy. It was really see how we're not sharing the good fortune with all people. Now, the right takes the view and says, look, when I first hired you, I had you handwrite these letters. And then I invested in a typewriter, and that made you a little more productive. You could do more letters per hour. And then a couple years later, I bought you an electric, IBM Selectric, and you became more proficient. And most recently, I bought you a personal computer and installed Microsoft Word on that, and now you're very productive. But your job's basically the same. And it was my investment in those capital items, and I need a return on that investment. So that's really where the debate comes. I like thinking about my own personal experience, you know, in farming. If I think back to 73, you know, through the early 80s, you know, we might have half dozen John Deere 95H combines and a bunch of 250 bushel wheat trucks and a kid in each one of those things, the harvest crew was significantly larger. Jump forward to today, one combine has the capacity, probably more capacity than everything, our entire fleet, and we've got one bank out wagon and a semi that's hauling 120,000 if you don't get weighed on the way to... Oh, you did pick up on that. I thought I'd slip that in there. I was just kidding on that. We would never do that. So I just thought that was really interesting. There's a really interesting debate, but we've got this departure. We need to think about it from a social standpoint, but today, as business owners, I just wanted to bring this up. So I've been talking about labor, and I hope this shares some insight on why this is such a difficult part of the economy for you right now. I was a little sarcastic when engaging in the minimum wage debate here in Oregon. I'm going to step out there, put my neck. You get up on the podium, you start feeling really brave. But sarcastically, as the Oregon president for Northwest Farm Credit, I said, awesome. Yeah, let's increase wages arbitrarily with the minimum wage because the marginal product of labor and the marginal product of capital means you're going to come talk to myself and other financial institutions. And as I travel around the state, we've turned adversity such as the heavy snow in the Treasure Valley area. And what did we do? We turned that adversity into an opportunity for tomorrow. When we rebuilt those onion packing pleds, processing plants, we put in the optical sorting and processing and shipping, and now we're investing in rail. Why? So that instead of 60 people on that floor, maybe I have 10. And that, you know, that accrues. That's why I was sarcastic, because we work and shift more to capital. I think here in the Willamette Valley, we see a lot of work being done, like in the blueberry area or in the seed area. You know, just ways, how can I reduce the number of employees that I have to have? Not only from an availability, not only from a cost, but the third thing I'd point out, what you already know, is exposing your operations to additional risk because of the compliance aspect. And as a banker, trust me, I understand the risk of compliance because we're heavily regulated as well. So I'm sorry, I don't have an optimistic outlook for a cure to labor, but I do think that historically, you know, the scarcity often promotes ingenuity, and you folks are the do that. We see that as we travel around, great ideas on how to reduce the dependence on labor that you can't find or can't afford. So let's talk a little bit about trade. Some of that's come up already. And, you know, we've probably seen this graph before. This is just U.S. ag exports. You know, here in Oregon, I've said it before, 80% of what you produce is exported. Half of that's international, half domestically here in the United States. So it's extremely important. Little editorial note, so let's all try to maintain our access to deep water navigation. It makes a lot of sense for our part of the world. As I think about trading partners, the top five would be China at $22 billion, Canada, Mexico, Japan, and the EU. Then the top 10 rounded out with South Korea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Indonesia, and Philippines. I think I want to talk about India and China here in a minute, but let's talk about the dollar. This basically tells your story right here. You can see the this is a U.S. dollar index. It's weighted against a variety of currencies. It was kind of the most general index I could find just to give you this high-level view. But you can see what happened as we, you can see the years of prosperity as the dollar weakened and made your exports much more attractive around the world. And that this is in a global ag sense, not just the seed group. But nonetheless, exports have remained robust. I think challenged by the dollar, it impacts the price. But right now, I think it's on my next slide. Before I move off of this one, we know that the Fed's going to meet next week, and there's the market has it at 100% probability that they will increase short-term rates again, and they've talked about it pretty openly. The market already has it priced in. It'd be a bigger shock if they didn't for some reason. So my point with that is that the U.S. has got a running head start on that quantitative easing that the Fed put in place following the housing crisis. In fact, we're starting to sell off the Fed balance sheet a little bit, but there's other important countries that are smack dab in the middle of that. And so as long as we're increasing interest rates, we're a pretty attractive investment, the old flight to quality. So what does that do to the dollar? Lifts it up, right? So exports seem to be clipping along much better this year than 15 or 16. However, I don't see a marked reduction in the value of the dollar simply because of that. I think it's important that we look at, the real kicker is some of these growing economies, and I like looking at BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. When you think about those five countries, and that would be the blue line on your graph, Brazil, Russia, and South Africa economies are pretty commodity dependent. And so when you think about the Black Sea region, we've got a worldwide glut of corn, soybeans, and wheat. That Black Sea region and in South America, they've adopted a lot of your farming practices. And I think part of what we're seeing worldwide in terms of this oversupply is just the up in their game in some of these developing economies. We do see on this graph that after declining growth trends, we had a turnaround in 2016. Things continue to look okay in 2017. I think it will trip along like that, but not at double-digit growth, especially with China involved in that, where we do expect to see growth in that 6 to 10% range, but it won't be the double-digit that we saw before. I wanted to share this with you. I hadn't really picked up on this, but we always talk China, China, China. And in fact, there's a study out there that claims that China is not the most populated country in the world. In fact, their central government miscounted, and currently India is the most populous in the world. And there's a little bit of a foot race between China and India as to who has the fastest growing economy. And a second, I just thought, wow, I didn't know that. And maybe one of the reasons as Oregonians we don't know that is in our top 10 list of countries that we export to, India is not in the list. So I kind of throw that out at you as a, we've got this paradigm that China is the number one economy, and it is right now, but let's keep our eye on it. I mean, they get to set the value of their currency. I just think we need to keep our eye on India it's always been a significant player, but I think we might be overly focused on China. So in conclusion, you know, I don't have to tell you this, especially with as we think about trade policy rhetoric and the potential for geopolitical event, anything like that, North Korea, that would change things significantly. I think I've covered the rest. I know that we need to. I wanted to talk briefly about energy, just because I know you spend. You know, we've got diesel fertilizer considerations. Here's the crude price WTI. The short story here on energy, when you think about it, is OPEC came together and said, let's curtail supply and try to elevate prices. But what happened? It stabilized the market, and they came up a little bit, but it really didn't have an influence, because as soon as oil approached, got over $50, and as it approached $60, which is roughly where it's at right now, you know, our own production kicks in and kind of holds that in check. So I think, I'm not sure how much... I just think there's a diminished OPEC influence on that energy market, and it seems to have played out several times. So over the next year, I think I'm not looking for a significant change in your fuel costs or your fertilizer costs. It'd be interesting to see other opinions grab me. One thing that happened our benefit, we had built up quite an inventory here in the United States, and the hurricanes hit, and we consumed some of that, but those inventories were record high. So bringing those down a little bit really didn't affect the market like people thought it could. That's my take on it. I just had to share this. I'm always, as you might guess, we're always asked, so where are interest rates at? So I just thought, well, I just celebrated my 30th year with Northwest Farm Credit. Let's just show LIBOR, which is the short-term rate, London Interbank Overnight Rate, for the last 30 years, and just look where it's at. I mean, short-term borrowing costs, interest rates generally continue to be, from a budget standpoint, as you plan your business, a pretty good opportunity. And the same thing when you look at 10-year, longer-term money. Here's the 10-year treasury. Sometimes I think we get caught up in the weekly interest rate charts. We just need to look at the big picture and the trend, because as Reagan pointed out, there's 3,000 answers, right? But this is the thing I really want to talk about. The yellow line is a year ago. I'll call it red line is a month ago, and the blue line is now. I'm just trying to show you what the shape of that yield curve from short to long maturities, what's happening, and it's flattening out. Why? Well, on the short end, next week, we already talked about that, the Fed is going to probably increase rates another quarter, and that will trickle across the economy. But what's happening on the long side is that's, for number one, the long side, you know, the 10 and 30 year maturities are influenced much more slowly than the short term. And there are factors like inflation expectations, economic growth, both of which have been pretty darn modest and muted. But it also has to do with central bank policy. And I mentioned earlier that in the EU and elsewhere around the world, they are still in the midst of their quantitative easing, which means they're building up their balance sheets. And so you have those two forces here at the United States flattening out that curve. Now, first I'll tell you that, who knows? You can call me a liar next year, but I really don't see a significant change in interest rates, either short or long, for the next 12 months. But if that yield curve gets inverted and short-term rates become higher than long-term rates, that has predicted the last 7 recessions. Now, this is not showing that right now, but that's something to keep in mind as you read the newspaper and watch TED Talks and whatnot. The other thing, though, is it's also fair to say that the last 7 recessions did not have a $14.7 trillion treasury market where the Fed was so heavily involved. Quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3, where they bought up treasuries. I don't know that we have experience. So another fair question that we will learn together going forward is this the new normal? So that's what I've got on rates. Last thing, I promised it, land values. You're going to zoom right into Oregon. Overall, USDA is saying that we're kind of in the middle. Prices have come up. I'll take you down to our numbers. Shows the same thing over time. A blend of land values from our appraisal group across the state show, fairly steady increase from 2010 forward. But I knew that you'd be especially interested for this group, although I know not everyone here today is from the Willamette Valley, but predominantly. This shows a similar trend of Willamette Valley farmland. I should mention that these values exclude improvements or even permanent plantings. We try to just get down to the dirt value for the purposes of this report, and it's a blend of irrigated cropland and whatnot. The red line is the number of sales. That will definitely increase for the 16 and 17 as we gather that data and amend our database. Last thing I wanted to leave you with, just a thought, if you will indulge me. I think about how an appraiser comes out to your place and appraises the property. They use three approaches to value: the market approach, where they go to try to find comparable sales and how does that compare to your place. Another one is the cost approach to value, where they figure out what would it cost to rebuild the seed cleaning plant and this house and other improvements. And the third approach to value is the income approach, and that's what I have up here. A real simple example: let's say that we have rent at $200 an acre and the capitalization rate is 2%. That would imply a $10,000 income approach to value. And next, and obviously I've picked easy numbers so that we can all think about this in our heads. What if the same $200 rental rate per acre, but the capitalization rate or the expectation is 4%? And in order to get that, that would imply a $5,000 per acre value. What if the rental rate goes down and the cap rate goes up? It shows a further decrease in value. Again, that's just one approach to value. And let's quickly point out that this approach to value doesn't consider, and I think an investor would, the expected appreciation. It's just like a stock. I buy the stock, and when I do, I think about what kind of dividends are they committed to paying, and what's the likelihood this stock will appreciate in the marketplace. And the combination of those two things, the current dividend income plus the likely appreciation, are how I make the decision to make that investment. And as we see more pragmatic forces come into the state, that being, large investment companies buying farmland, they may have take a look at this. And I would point out, although as I gave you this example, I was thinking primarily of Midwest corn ground, where we see net farm income decreasing, and we've already talked about the anticipation, and rates have come up a little bit, a percent or so over the last year. So I'm saying the numerator is going down and the denominator seems to be coming up, and I'm just wondering how will that impact our land values moving forward. But then I'm quickly adding, there are a lot of other factors, and I just know that you're always interested in that. I think if you look at that acre of ground in the context of crop A that generates a modest return, and somebody else thinks they can grow crop B, we see a lot of people moving to hazelnuts, the attraction of profit, and there's other reasons. What would they be willing to pay for that? So I kind of refer to that. We can't let our capital investment be complacent. Okay, I think I'm a little bit over time, so I just want to end with this comment. All of us are responsible to be champions of the natural resources industry, and we never know which one of us will have that opportunity to speak to a legislator or influence the urban population. And out on our website, we commissioned a study with Oregon State that worked with University of Idaho and WSU. And I just, This is the economic impact. The full study is available out on our website, but if you remember anything, you're talking to that friend that lives in Portland, just say, well, our industry, that being ag, forestry, and fisheries here in the state of Oregon, connects to 250,000 jobs and has nearly a $50 billion impact on our economy. I think it's important they understand that. With that, I think I went into your break just a little bit, but I appreciate your time. Happy to visit with you in the hallway. Thank you. Oh, I thought I had until 9:45. Is there a question? Not a hard one? I guess I have a couple minutes. Yes, ma'am. They look, some of those charts that I showed you would be an all-in cost for an employee, but generally when I was talking about real wages, I was mostly focused on just the wage part, not including the benefits. But it's a great question because certainly the benefit cost has been increasing too. There's an all-in cost is markedly different today. I know that in our analysis, that's going to be in the neighborhood of 30%. Actually, a little bit better than 30%. Thank you. Any other questions? I'm sorry. Okay, thank you.